The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Profiles, you're absolutely right, and I think we discussed this, and they're so diverse. So you have a lot of interesting stories, even from a journalistic point of view, very, very, very fascinating. It ranges, I think we open in the report with the story of the two newlyweds from Mississippi, small town Mississippi. She's a convert, African-American, prom queen, cheerleader in high school, daughter of a local police officer. When converts, and she's quite radical, marries a son of an imam, and they decide to go and have children, which are called the cubs, for the future cubs of the caliphate. And I think you have a lot of these very random cases of young people that need some kind of direction in life, get infatuated with a strong message. It is sort of the cool counterculture of today. There's really no other strong counter-society message, but what's more anti-society, anti-establishment than ISIS?
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 19th, 2015. That was Lorenzo Vedino, who recently co-authored a new report entitled ISIS in America, From Retweets to Raqqa, discussing the path to radicalization experienced by some of ISIS's most vulnerable recruits. This week, we asked Lorenzo and his co-author, Seamus Hughes, both from the George Washington University Program on Extremism, into the studio to discuss the report. Their study looked at 71 Americans charged with ISIS-related activities. So what common denominators did they find within the group? How much of a role does social media play in radicalization and recruitment? And what should law enforcement do to counter violent extremism? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 151, ISIS in America, Disrupting Retweets from Raqqa.
So let's just start with an overview of the report. It's gotten a lot of attention, but for those who haven't, you know, read the New York Times or read the other sort of stories about the paper, what are the big takeaways here?
Well, we basically did two things here. We looked at every individual that's been charged in the U.S. for ISIS-related activities, and that's 71 individuals. And that's already a first takeaway, which is much larger number than any kind of jihadist mobilization in the past in the U.S.
So what does that compare to? I mean, when you say much larger, it's much larger than what?
Than what Al-Qaeda used to mobilize. We generally have to... Basically, every year since 9/11, we had around 15, 20 arrests every year. That's more or less the number. This year alone, we're up to 56 arrests. So we're 3-4 times the size of what we normally had. We had the FBI talking about 900 investigations open in all 50 states. Again, these are numbers that are completely different from the mobilizations we had in the past. So I think that's a big takeaway, which has major policy implications and a major implication on how law enforcement works and takes care of this problem is just a sheer size of people who are ISIS sympathizers, with, of course, different degrees of intensity. You cannot put them all in the same category. But the passion, in a way, that ISIS has stirred, and of course, a statistically insignificant number of individuals in the broader American Muslim population, but from a security point of view, it's an unprecedented number.
So one of the things when you increase the numbers a lot, as a general matter, the quality goes down.
At least that's what you would expect, right? When that you're dealing with lower quality individuals as operatives. Does this bear that out, or is this a group of people who are notable for maintaining quality even as the quantity goes up?
No, generally speaking, it's absolutely true. The quality has gone down. Again, generalizing things a bit, but people that were linked to Al-Qaeda in the past, it kind of ran the gamut also back then, but you had a lot of people that had deep operational ties to Al-Qaeda that had gone to training camps, which were in many cases directed by Al-Qaeda to carry out attacks. Nowadays, we do not really see a lot of that. There's a spectrum of the 71 people who have been charged. You have a handful who have gone to Syria, fought with ISIS, or had connections with ISIS. But I would say the majority are just people who are inspired by ISIS. And some of them are, you know, kids in their parents' basement who are active 24/7 on Facebook. They never met a like-minded individual in the physical space. Obviously, from an operational point of view, they cannot pose the same kind of threat that some guys are part of a cell, you know, 9/11 kind of style. It's a completely different ballgame. At the same time, that lack of connection is sort of a double-edged sword because, of course, they are much more difficult to detect. They're much more unpredictable. They do not have those outside communications with overseas that make them more easy to detect for the FBI. So, obviously, that lack of sophistication is balanced in a negative way by the fact that they are not connected to a larger group and are more difficult to detect.
So what should we be more frightened of? The relatively small number of quite highly trained operatives who are coming in from outside with direction and training from a central group, or a much larger group of relatively untrained, relatively disconnected, independent operatives who are likely to commit lower level offenses if successful, but can still be quite deadly, which is the main story here. ISIS a mile wide but an inch deep, or is the main story here, you know, gosh, still an inch, you know, maybe only an inch deep, but boy is it wide?
I think we have both dynamics. I think so far we have seen all individuals who are inspired. Garland, Texas, I think to some degree you can argue Chattanooga, San Bernardino, apparently, all these different dynamics where we have individuals with no operational connections or very, very limited operational connections, just inspired. And obviously it's not a big attack of a big sophistication. But I think in Europe they would have said the same thing until a month ago. And then we saw Paris, that was, of course, a different scale. It was something that was planned Al-Qaeda style, old school. Listen, the number of people that are involved in ISIS in the U.S. is so much smaller than in European countries, but I think that's also a scenario that shouldn't be completely dismissed as unlikely. Let's also keep in mind another thing. Sure, our report focuses on ISIS. We still have other groups operating in that sort of jihadist galaxy with ties in the U.S. Just over the last month or so, we have seen individuals indicted for links to Al-Qaeda and for links to Al-Shabaab. So there's also that dynamics. And in many cases, you know, the distinction between these groups, especially when we get to the West, are not as clear-cut. You have individuals who sort of have one foot in one group and one foot in the other. They just espouse jihadist ideology. They want to attack the U.S. So if maybe on the ground in Syria that distinction is very important, when we get to the West, it's almost secondary in many cases.
Okay, so 71, you said?
71 charge.
71 charge. This is a pretty big sample. What can we say about the average person? What's the range of human experience reflected in this group of people?
Right. So we looked at over about 7,000 pages of legal documents. Just got to get a sense of what, you know, this profile looks like. The biggest takeaway being there's not one profile. But in terms of average age, they were 26. In one-third of the cases, they were 21 years or younger. The oldest case was an individual who was 47 and an Air Force veteran. And the youngest was a 15-year-old kid from Pennsylvania. So in age, it kind of ranges. They primarily were male, so 84% were male. And then 86% were male, and 14% were female. So you had 61 arrests of male and 10 of female. They were arrested in 21 different states. although the FBI says they have active investigations in all 50 states, the vast majority were more interested in travel overseas. So they were more interested in going to the so-called caliphate than they were in domestic plotting. And we may see a shift in the coming months on that, but in terms of the numbers we looked at, 40% were converts to Islam, which is a higher percentage than American Muslims writ large, which is at 23%. So you kind of get a sense of the scene. But again, you take a look at the actual profiles of the 71, I mean, it runs the gamut of what it looks like. Old, young, rich, poor, high school kids, and then college educated. There's not one necessary profile in it.
I'm wondering if you can walk us through maybe the path to radicalization or a case or two. Does it start with social media? Is it someone logs onto Twitter and they see something, or they see something on CNN and go check it out? Or is this, does it start somewhere else?
Yeah, and Lorenzo should jump in. It's a highly individualized process and very complex and complicated when you look at a person, just because by the very nature, humans are complex and why they do things are different. So grievances run the gamut in terms of what people are interested in, and also in terms of, you know, what actually gets someone, you know, hooked on this. You know, we saw the case of Shannon Conley, a 9-year-old from Denver, Colorado, who kind of got interested online and then reached out to an individual online to essentially marry him and go overseas. So that's like one spectrum of the social media type of loner type of thing. The other spectrum is a case of Abdullah Pizarro. He's a guy who lived in the States for 20 years, from St. Louis, was friends with a number of people in St. Louis and New York and Illinois, all from the same hometown in Bosnia. They all come over here. Abdullah Pizarro gets his U.S. citizenship, and then a week later gets on a plane and then ends up eventually into Syria, running a battalion of foreign fighters, mostly from the Balkans. So you have that type of random spectrum. And then the six people that he knew from the States were all, you know, sending him money and gear that he needed, so he had a support system here. So every person is different, which makes it hard in terms of policy recommendations of what you do on these type of things.
All right, so let's talk about those policy recommendations. If you have a combination of a large volume of cases, a very diverse presentation of who you're looking for if you extrapolate from the existing cases, and not a lot of common threads between them, what do you do if you're the FBI? I mean, what's the right lesson for them to take from this?
I think that's basically two things. It's a very complex situation. I think one is resources, and the other one is branching out. By resources, what I mean is that right now, even though it's not as bad as in some Western European countries, the dynamic is this. You have a few thousands, according to the FBI, individuals who are ISIS sympathizers, who are attracted to the ideology, who are online and active consumers of ISIS ideology. Again, the vast majority of these people will never make the leap from being keyboard jihadists to actually being militants. Some will. And what the FBI is doing, like all European counterparts are doing, is struggling to figure out who's going to make that leap, because there are no indicators. Every case is different. Every trajectory is different. And in many cases, there's no indicator showing that they're going to make that leap. I think San Bernardino shows it. Yeah, she posted a bayat to Baghdadi just a few hours, apparently, before doing something. So that's too late. So you need massive manpower to control what's going on, not just in the physical space, to monitor what's going on in the physical space and the online space. And you can have a lot of softwares, and you can, of course, there's a lot of talk about getting social media, the industry being more cooperative, but bottom line, you need a lot of people to surveil all that space, so the physical and the online space, because the numbers are so big. So resources is one, and second is connected to resources, is because bottom line, the numbers are so big and it's so difficult to identify people, it's not a job that the law enforcement can do alone. And this is something, again, that the FBI acknowledges, and it's a bit of a culture shift there, where they acknowledge they cannot arrest their way out of this problem, that they need the help of communities, they need the help of schools, they need the help of families, because those are the people who are best positioned to detect signs of radicalization. They are the ones who can make the referral, who can go to the FBI and identify certain dynamics. A lot of these activities move from the pre-criminal space to actual violence very quickly. And so the FBI cannot intervene in the pre-criminal space, and the support of society at large is crucially important. Yeah.
So let's talk about social media. How, you know, it's now sort of a buzzword whenever somebody talks about ISIS is their presence on social media. You guys have mentioned it a few times, and the volume of stuff that you need to monitor on social media. How big an issue is social media in the life of ISIS and its reach into the United States?
Yeah, I think we tend to overplay the role of social media when it comes to radicalization or recruitment in the U.S. I think there is the importance for the reason why you have these numbers is probably mostly tied to the fact that there is an actual Islamic State, you know, somewhere someone can go with all of those, you know, religious and perceived religious things, you know, overtones going over that. So there's that draw, I think, is very important. And I think we tend to think that social media is the reason why people are joining ISIS. I think it's also the fact that you have somewhere to go. And in terms of the role of social media in general, you know, we've seen cases, and Minneapolis is a great one, where you had the first wave of individuals go to Syria, and then they called their neighborhood friends they've known for years and said, come on over. Sure, they used Facebook to communicate with them, but it wasn't the reason why the 15 people from Minneapolis left it there wasn't because of social media. So we tend to overplay that. In terms of the look at the size of it, we looked at 300 accounts of people we believed to be Americans that were ISIS sympathizers on Twitter. And now if you give the larger look at Twitter, that's a very small subset of people, and I imagine we missed a few just by the nature of doing the business. So it's a very small scene online, particularly in America. They tend to have to know each other. It tends to be an echo chamber. You know, you have block lists and people kicking each other out, and you share memes and you share violent videos, but you also talk about the boringly benign stuff of everyday life. So it really just kind of complements the real world.
So how would you describe, if we were all being sober about the role of social media, how would you describe it? Is this a one feature among many? Is ISIS's use of it profoundly different from prior groups? What's the right way to think about it? It shows up in the title of your paper.
It is unique, but because social media has exploded over the last few years, it's not like Al-Qaeda wasn't doing it 10 years ago because social media was not as all pervasive as it is now. So obviously it's a bit of luck in a way. I think ISIS is a very lucky organization, but it just happens to be very good at exploiting opportunities they have, but they had this both the geopolitical and the technological opportunity that just presented themselves. So of course you need to be good at seizing opportunities, and ISIS does that, and it's ISIS as an organization that has a very good structure in Syria and Iraq and an ability to put out very well crafted media, very powerful, very immediate, with a lot of different audiences in mind. So there's obviously an ability there. There's also a large number of people, particularly in the West, but not only, that are very good at disseminating that message that comes from centralized ISIS. So people that are not necessarily formally affiliated to ISIS, but are sympathizers and take it upon themselves to disseminate that message. And again, the message it's very diverse, appeals to different emotions. Some of it is more about violence. Some of it is more about the creation of an Islamic State. It's more religious, theological. So this diversity of messages is absolutely key. But I think it's because they have a powerful message. Let's look at it from a marketing point of view. You can have a great marketing campaign, but if you don't have a good product, nobody's going to buy it.
So you think if you take away Twitter and the other social media platforms from ISIS, and they had to do it all by phone, by letter, by email, it's inconvenient for them, but it's not profoundly different from what it is now.
It would not be able to have this broad appeal, but obviously there would be people. I mean, people were joining Al-Qaeda even from America 20 years ago, and back then propaganda was done through flyers and video cassettes. And yet people were joining. Now, obviously, social media allows them a much broader reach. Random kid in rural Mississippi can be attracted to the message, you know, be able to be even introduced to the message in the first place, and then connect to like-minded individuals and even to the real deal, to ISIS. I mean, the ability that you have, if you live in the middle of nowhere, you have the ability to speak in real time to somebody who's fighting in Syria and Iraq. That's extremely powerful. That's extremely novel. Having said that, you know, Al-Qaeda was mobilizing through video cassettes 20 years ago, and Al-Qaeda never had the success that the Islamic State had in creating a caliphate. That's unprecedented. That's the big part. Social media amplifies what is a powerful message.
So you touched on some of the one of the policy solutions was more manpower, more physical surveillance. I'm wondering if you can talk about the role of FBI informants in the arrest and charging of these individuals, and perhaps some of the tension that that sets up in the community where you say that that's the greatest source of intelligence, and how law enforcement officials should think about that tension.
So in 39 of the cases we looked at, they used an FBI informant or undercover officer. So it's still a tool that the FBI uses relatively regularly. But it's also a tool they use in any other form of investigation, whether that's bank robbery or corruption or things like that. So I think we tend to think that informants are bad if you're community partners, but it's a tool that they use no matter what. The question is how you pitch it. And I used to, when I was at the National Counterterrorism Center, I was a countervailing extremism officer. So I go around to mosques and community centers. I'm talking about terrorism and how ISIS recruits online. And the pushback was all, you know, the use of informants and things like that. There are relevant and important issues on those type of things. I think the FBI is incumbent on them to explain the technique, explain how it's not particularly novel when it comes to these type of things. Use it sparingly when you can. But they also have a responsibility to prevent attacks. And then, you know, Director Comey will be in front of Feinstein the next day if something happens, which he was this week, right? So they have to kind of balance those two extremes. They also have to balance the two extremes of using informants but also trying to do community engagement. And it's not an easy line to walk.
And are you satisfied with the line as it's being walked, or do you think there's improvements that this body of cases suggests they could be making?
I think right now there is not a third option between doing nothing and arresting individuals. So if you have something you're concerned about, if you're the FBI, it's either hope it's a phase, open an assessment, and then hope you close it, or arrest them and provide arrest them and material support. And because there's no third option, they're being forced to use hard law enforcement tools.
So you actually, yeah. You talked about this a little bit in a foreign policy essay on Lawfare a few months back entitled Material Support or Bust, which was this idea that there is no third option, right? You know, the only approach to countering violent extremism is to surveil somebody and then arrest them for material support. And you advocated for some kind of policy of disengagement and intervention. How many of the 71 cases would you consider to be people who were, you know, quote, radicalized but still reachable? And then maybe what would that program look like?
Maybe I'll talk a little bit about the cases, and Lorenzo can give an overview of the European approach, because I think it's relevant to the American aspect of it. When you look at the 71 cases, again, it runs a spectrum of, you know, really concerning individuals, like Abdullah Bizarro running a battalion of guys. You know, at some point, that's arrest, right? And we've all agreed that you've crossed the legal threshold, and it's time to be locked away. You know, in the case of Shannon Conley, they tried numerous times to try to, they met with her 9 different times to try to bring her back into the fold and say, you know, what you're seeing is wrong and ISIS is incorrect. The FBI did. The problem when these in that case is, and in other cases where they try intervention, is a lot of it's ad hoc. So it's an FBI agent who is particularly forward-leaning and wants to try to do something new, but he doesn't know the tools of it. He doesn't have the legal protections to do it. He doesn't know how to, you know, pass over classified information to community partners who may be able to do this. There's a whole host of policy issues that makes it hard to actually do an intervention in real life. Also, sometimes it won't stick, and we need to acknowledge that there's going to be a level of failure in the system on these type of things. So I think there's a number of cases that we've seen in the past where perhaps an intervention option may have been the more relevant choice than the final option.
yeah, the European, I mean, we've been somewhat advocates of some of the European approaches, and of course, fully understanding that there are cultural, legal, political differences, threat environment is different, but I think some of the ideas of what is CV in Europe, or not all of it, but at least some, I think, are useful and should be at least studied in the US, but I would argue even adopted. And one of these is the system of one-on-one interventions. It changes from country to country, but you have it basically in Denmark, in the Netherlands, in the UK, where basically you have a system where there's a unit at the local level. All this work is generally done with a national guideline, sort of a national framework, but very much at the local level, because that's really where radicalization takes place and dynamics change from city to city, from community to community. And you have basically an entity, in some cases there's a stronger presence of the police, in some other cases absolutely zero presence of the police, different dynamics. But that unit basically deals with all issues of radicalization in the locality, in the town, in the city. And what happens is that there's a system of individuals, basically everybody who's considered a stakeholder, anybody that for a variety of reasons can potentially come in contact with people who radicalize. So it's school teachers, social workers, health workers, local cops, community leaders, you name it, soccer coaches. Basically, when this individual spot a certain case of an individual that is giving signs of radicalization, and of course everybody received some sort of basic training on what radicalization is, what the signs are, and so on, goes to that specific unit and refers the case. And listen, you know, that individual, a student of mine, is giving signs of radicalization. And then what the unit does is that it assesses the case, see if there's reason to be concerned. If it is a behavior that is criminal, refers the case to the police. If it's not, it sets up an intervention. And by intervention, it generally means sending a mentor, somebody that can basically gain the trust of the target, of the young person, and try to sway him away from radicalism. So if you look at it, you know, there's different ways of looking at it. Initially, the reaction you get from a lot of people, particularly in the U.S., is that it's very Big Brother. You know, it's very, you know, these are people who are just expressing views that are controversial, protected by the First Amendment. There shouldn't be something like that. And I see that point, but if you look at it at the system, actually, the system is set up not to criminalize people, but it's actually set up to prevent these people from criminalizing themselves. It's really not operated in part, and in fact, in a lot of European countries, and I think this is the way, if it were to be implemented in the U.S., the way it should be, there should be a wall between the information that is gleaned during these interventions and the information that is used in a prosecution. So two separate processes, which at the same time would overlap, because you would have somebody who is being intervened upon by this entity and at the same time is being investigated by authorities. Because, of course, it's not like because you do your nice, soft intervention, you stop the hard investigation, obviously. But the system are separate, with the occasional overlap and occasional exchange of information. But the European experience tells us that it does work in many cases. The Brits talk about the new and improved version of Channel with a 60% success rate. Obviously, we're talking about people who are caught at the beginning of the radicalization trajectory. The sooner you catch them, the sooner you spot them, the easier it is for the intervention to succeed. But if you manage to cut down the number by 60%, that's a big thing. It's cheap, and it allows then law enforcement to focus in on the really bad guys and carry out arrests. So I think it's something that it's an experience that at least needs to be studied.
So I'm looking at this list of 71 individuals, and one of the striking things about it is how few of their names I know, you know, and Lawfare is as likely to report when one of these indictments happen as any place, and, you know, a lot of these people are people whose names I wouldn't recognize. I'm interested in two things. First off, what are the truly outlying cases here that are sort of most striking or most alarming for any reason that strikes the two of you? And secondly, I'm wondering if to what extent this body of cases as a group sheds light on the sort of going dark debate that has been going on between the FBI and civil libertarians over the use of encryption, and to what extent do these cases show evidence of communications that were unable to be deciphered by law enforcement once investigations had started.
The profiles, you're absolutely right, and I think we discussed this, and they're so diverse. So you have a lot of interesting stories, even from a journalistic point of view. Very, very, very fascinating. It ranges. I think we open in the report with the story of the two newlyweds from Mississippi, small town Mississippi. She's a convert, African American, prom queen, cheerleader in high school, daughter of a local police officer. When converts, and she's quite radical, marries son of an imam. And they decide to go and have children, which we call the cubs, for the future cubs of the caliphate. And I think you have a lot of these very random cases of young people that need some kind of direction in life, get infatuated with a strong message. It is sort of the cool counterculture of today. There's really no other strong counter-society message. But what's more anti-society, anti-establishment than ISIS? But then you have the old timers, you have the old school guys. I think another case that is interesting is, but I haven't gotten any play, to be honest, that's been reported at all, is that of an entire family. Only one guy is in that's charged, that it's in the list, but we know that his father and his brother also traveled from San Diego, California, to Syria. They are of Syrian origin. I think decent, pretty well-to-do family, has property in the Aleppo area. When they go back, when the civil war starts, they join Jabhat al-Nusra, and they become pretty prominent in Jabhat al-Nusra, joining the Sharia Council at the local level in Aleppo. And at some point, when the fights break between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS, he, particularly one of them, the one who gets charged, becomes sort of a middleman between the two groups. I mean, you don't get to that level of being the middleman between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS if you're just some random schmuck. It's obviously somebody that has very serious connections and so on. It really shows the spectrum here of what we're talking about. I would say there's probably more of the former category, the randoms, the kids who are just infatuated with a strong message. But you have occasionally also the hard ones.
And do you see any indication one way or another of the use of encryption and how it's whether the group of cases either supports or refutes or tends in either direction with respect to the FBI's complaints?
Well, it is difficult for us as a research institution to really know that. I mean, we did 6 months monitoring of the scene on Twitter. Because, of course, that's publicly accessible. We are aware, well, first of all, we hear it from the FBI all the time, whether publicly or in our conversations, that they are moving in those spaces, moving to the dark web to encrypt the platforms. We do see that occasionally they say, you know, let's move the conversation. They start engaging, let's say, on Twitter, and then they move the conversation somewhere else. They say, okay, let's talk through, and basically use other platforms. I think it's Kick sometimes, but even more sophisticated stuff at times. And obviously, when you read some indictments, and you obviously see that some of the information that the FBI reveals in those indictments, there's clearly a lot of stuff happening, but it's not just what's visible to us on Twitter.
But you don't see in the court papers that allegations that there were encrypted communications or anything like that.
There's nothing I can think of in the public record for the most part. No.
That's interesting.
No, not in the public record. Although the indictments, just by the nature of indictments, you put at least amount of what you need to do in order to get an indictment.
Right, although often what you do put in when people take steps to conceal and, you know, that's the sort of thing that you might very well put in an indictment if you're trying to, I mean, it sort of depends how you're charging something.
Right. We've seen people use essentially secret personas online, but not encryption. In charging documents, it should be clear. In charging documents, I haven't seen them.
I think my other question would be, you mentioned that there's been a shift away from Twitter. To where are they going?
Yeah.
And what do those conversations look like, or were you able to monitor any of them? I don't know, I'm thinking Telegram, which is a bit more open to the outside. They have those their channels, right? What does that look like versus Twitter?
Yeah, we look primarily on Twitter, although they do use Telegram, especially to push out daily press releases. So ISIS releases their two-page press release in English in various different languages, and you can see what they did for the day. So they use that type of platform to push that out. But we saw that people started getting exhausted with the suspensions online. So, for example, in the beginning of summer, we watched a gentleman, Terrence McNeil. He was a lone wolf 14 online when we started, watching him, and then by the time he got arrested at the end of the summer, he was lone wolf 21. So he had been kicked off 7 times and come back as lone wolf 15, 16, 17, 18. By the time he was 20, lone wolf 20, he started his own Tumblr page because there's a little bit more freedom there. They're not as aggressive on takedown, and you can essentially own the space a little bit more. As great as 140 characters are, if you want to personalize it a little bit more, you want to move over to kind of different platforms. So it's not necessarily that they're moving from Twitter to the dark web, is they're moving to just different platforms in general, and not just staying on Twitter.
So what are the preferred platforms now? I mean, for those of our audience who really want to sort of go out and find jihadis online, where are the cool kids hanging out?
Yeah, I think Tumblr's a big deal. I think we've seen that in the last few weeks, of people kind of creating their own Tumblr accounts, linking it to their Twitter account. The Twitter account goes down, then so be it, and they can keep their Tumblr account. Facebook plays a role, but they use closed groups. So it's very hard, both from a research perspective and if you're not in that circle, to be able to get in.
They don't let you in if you no. if you tell them I'm from GW.
Researching extremists.
Actually, you'd be surprised. I think Lorenzo and I's experience when you're talking to extremists, not in this context, but in other contexts, is, for the most part, they like to talk. They have a worldview that they believe in, and they'd like to convince you of it. I spent a good amount of time trading letters with an American jihadi, Zach Chesser, in jail, and he was prolific in writing to me because he wanted to convince me of his world belief. And Lorenzo's got countless stories of that kind of dynamic. So I think there's an interesting touch on talking to extremists and get a sense of what their radicalization process was.
And do you find that there's, I would think though that in the context of a recruitment effort, that would not be the context in which they would want to engage you.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So one of the other things that Director Comey has said is that the ISIS use of social media is like a little devil sitting on people's shoulders 24 hours a day, whispering in their ears, kill, kill, kill. Is that the major function that they're using? Some other people talk about it kind of more as an organizing tool, some more as an outreach tool. How, other than the fact that you think the use of Twitter is somewhat overstated, What is its major purpose in this movement?
There's a variety of purposes. I think what Comey was talking about is probably the end of the spectrum of when you have the mobilization. And I think we have seen a few cases. I mean, if you think about Garland, the attack was exactly a dynamic like that, where you had somebody that was basically involved in jihadist activities for more than 10 years. But undeniably was that role of social media in basically pushing him to carry out an attack. The fact that he was in direct contact with people who were sort of egging him on to carry out an attack, that clearly was a dynamic. But again, there's only a few cases really of attacks. I think what is more common is the ability to connect like-minded individuals, the ability of, and again, like any other internet community, the ability of finding what is a niche grew ideology, finding other people with whom to discuss, with whom to share thoughts, to share videos, to share links, and so on. So it's a bad role in the radicalization process. We do see cases of ISIS sympathizers proactively reaching and targeting vulnerable people. So yeah, in most cases, I would argue that it's people who self-radicalize who then reach out and find like-minded people or try to mobilize. But you have cases of ISIS sympathizers, maybe not so much in the States, but in other countries, reaching out and finding young, vulnerable people And trying to send the message. I mean, we've seen cases, for example, of ISIS trying to infiltrate popular hashtags and in Twitter communities where they think they can find sympathy. For example, the Black Lives Matter during Ferguson, you had ISIS guys infiltrating that space and telling people, you see, America is a terrible country, it's a racist country, join the caliphate, we're all brothers under Islam, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, there are no police shootings in the caliphate.
Absolutely. So how successful that effort is you know, debatable and probably not that high. But they try to do that. There is a role in the mobilization phase in a few say occasional circumstances. It's in an attack phase, as the kill quote shows. But I think it's mostly the mobilization case. So what do you do when you're actually done with just consuming propaganda and you want to do something, which is in most cases, as we've seen, going to Syria? You got to find, and this is probably one of the main reasons why the scene in the U.S., the numbers in the U.S. are much smaller than in Europe, but you don't have a lot of facilitators in the physical space. You don't have the recruiters that exist in a lot of neighborhoods in European cities. If you want to mobilize and go to Syria, you live in Brussels, Paris, London, Copenhagen, it's fairly easy to find somebody, go to the right neighborhood, right mosque, right... talk to the right people. It's fairly easy to find somebody who will facilitate that trip. In the U.S., it's much more difficult. It's difficult to find those connections. That's where the social media, the internet and social media in particular, play a role. So we have seen many cases. This is the dynamic. These people try to reach out to people and say, how do I go there? And that's where the FBI, in many cases, step in. So, yes, in many cases, they do find an actual ISIS facilitator, but in many cases it's an undercover FBI agent, and that's how a lot of these things are done.
Maybe the other part I think is important in the report is we separate the Twitter scene into three different categories. You know, the nodes, the guys that push out the propaganda, the amplifiers who are retweeting, essentially the microphone for getting the information out, and I think the most important one and most relevant is the shout-out accounts. So they're accounts that announce when things get kicked out. So when Lone Wolf 15 gets kicked off and comes back as Lone Wolf 16, there's a shout-out account that says, you know, brothers and sisters, follow Lone Wolf 16. He's a good guy.
Oh, interesting.
So okay. There's a level of resiliency because they're constantly being kicked off for terms of service violations. We have seen the example of, just playing off of that, of the logistical support of essentially acting as travel agents, too. So Muhammad Khan, a 19-year-old individual from Chicago who just pled guilty to material support, him and his two underage siblings went to O'Hare Airport. They were planning on going to Syria, and in his possession was the numbers of people to call when he landed in Turkey. So he'd have a number of people that would help him get through the border, and also a step-by-step guide in English of what to talk to customs about, what to bring, what not to bring, all that he got from online contacts.
Thank you both very much. This is the report is called ISIS in America from Retweets to Raqqa, from the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.